This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, 10 years after a murder conviction was thrown out because of racist prosecution practices, the Philadelphia District Attorney is pressing for the death penalty against Sugar Bear Lark. And activists across the country turn out for National Stop Police Brutality Day.
But first, people around the world are marking the 100th anniversary of the Great October Russian Revolution. Next year will mark the 150th anniversary of the birth of the great scholar and activist, W.E.B. Du Bois. In Philadelphia, Du Boisian scholar Dr. Anthony Montira is celebrating both anniversaries.
Certainly the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution is a great moment for reflection, for mobilization, and for thinking about the future. And certainly as we think about the future of humanity, we look to W.E.B. Du Bois, who not only looked backward to historical events, but was really a thinker who thought about the future and what would happen to humanity as the crises of the colonial system and the imperial systems became more intense. So in 2018, we here in Philadelphia will declare that year the year of Du Bois, and we'll enter upon a series of activities and events to mark Du Bois' 150th anniversary.
And of course, Philadelphia has a special attachment to W.E.B. Du Bois, who wrote that landmark study of the Philadelphia Negro, which many people accept as being one of the best examples of modern sociology.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And of course, we will be thinking back to the Philadelphia Negro, that landmark study, as you put it, of urban sociology. But we will be looking at the totality of Du Bois's work, including The Souls of Black Folk, Black Reconstruction in America, The World and Africa, his novel, The Dark Princess, and his collection of essays known as Dark Water. And we will initiate in March of 2018 a year-long project that we call Philadelphia Reads W.E.B. Du Bois. And we're modeling it upon the literacy campaign that took place after the Cuban Revolution in 1961. And we're talking about technical reading, but we're also talking about political literacy. It's interesting, Glenn, that the numbers for illiteracy in the Cuban urban centers at the time of the revolution and the numbers for illiteracy in Philadelphia in 2017 are about the same. So this campaign of Philadelphia Reads W.E.B. Du Bois will be in a lot of ways a literacy campaign and a campaign of democracy and enlightened citizenry. And we hope that we will affect the thinking of the Black working class and poor, and in so doing, we hope to affect the capacity of our people in Philadelphia, this poorest of the major cities in the United States, to affect our ability to fight for our rights, to fight for peace, and to fight for justice.
Well, there's literacy, which in its basic sense, just means being able to read words on paper. And then there's political literacy, which is something quite different.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And often the two go hand in hand. You know, you got a lot of people who would claim to be able to read and write technically, but do not basically have a politics that will help them understand what they're reading. So a lot of people think that reading is reading, and that's not true. To really get meaning out of what you're reading and to critically read what you're reading, you need a politic. And so we're going to start with this great political education and mobilization. You know, Du Bois was not one of these sterile academics or these academic careerists. He was engaged. Often we refer to him as a activist scholar. I think we could better put it as a scholar who had a politics and a radical ideology. And it is from that standpoint that we hope to read and teach Du Bois, and in so doing, teach the modern world, the modern crisis, and what are some of the proposals that could come from the life worlds of ordinary people about how to solve these crises in the interest of the people.
Yes, I've been reading the New York Times all of my literate life. Half of it is lies and all of it is hostile to my interests. But with political literacy, you can read through that.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And, you know, that's what Du Bois offers us. And, you know, Glenn, one of the reasons that we want to embark upon this campaign, this grassroots campaign, and I should say, you know, we're going to read various of his works, different places will be reading different works, but we will be in churches, in libraries, in union halls, in bookstores. Hopefully, when the weather gets warm, we'll be outside in street corners, we'll be in charter schools and in public schools, and we'll be throughout Philadelphia. And we hope to impact thousands of people. And as you say, you know, a lot of people can read the New York Times, but from a political standpoint, they don't know what they're reading. And a lot of people just abandon reading because they feel that most of what is printed is a lie or does not represent their interests. So we hope that this will be a political campaign, but it will be a campaign of political and ideological literacy.
And of course, when you say we, you're talking about the Philadelphia Free Saturday School with which you've been involved for.
That's right. The Saturday Free School will be the engine of it, but it will not be exclusively the Saturday Free School. We hope that this can be a coalition or united front of many forces who are interested in what we're doing and interested in Du Bois and interested, frankly, in the future.
Lots of people pay lip service to the greatness of Du Bois and will be marking his 150th birthday. But I know from your writings that you think that lots of these folks don't really get Du Bois or may even, in fact, be opposite Du Bois politically.
Yeah, there's no question. And, you know, to really understand how Du Bois was erased from public discourse and from academic discourse, you have to understand McCarthyism and the Cold War. And as you know, Du Bois, at the start of the Cold War in the late 1940s, stood up against nuclear weapons and nuclear war and opposed the American government's war in Korea and so on. And he therefore was targeted as a so-called enemy of the American government, and as the government put it, an agent of a foreign government. He was thereby erased from public discourse. Few books were written on him, hardly an article in an academic or other journal was written on him. He was not taught at all, and it was left mainly to his political enemies to define who he was. It was only with the end of the Cold War that it became somewhat acceptable to talk about Du Bois. And then as they began to talk about Du Bois, it was often in a distorted way. Du Bois was talked about through the lenses of anti-communism, of anti-socialism. He was interpreted incorrectly. That was mainly academics, but also public figures. So even at this date, this late date, Du Bois is hardly understood. Certainly, I would say most academics get him wrong. They seek to diminish him. I am of the opinion that Du Bois' writing and thinking fits better with ordinary people than with the academic petty bourgeoisie. And I think this literacy campaign, this Philadelphia Reads Du Bois campaign, will be our effort to test that hypothesis.
Well, certainly this McCarthyism that attempted to make a non-person out of W.E.B. Du Bois is back with a vengeance. And
yes.
Du Bois might be eliminated through algorithms from the pages of Facebooks and Googles today.
True that. But, you know, we, I think, are in a somewhat better position to fight for the legacy of Du Bois and for the truths that Du Bois left us. And I say we're in a better situation because of the nature of the political crisis in the United States, the crisis not only of white leadership, but a crisis of black leadership. And tens of millions of especially black people are looking for answers, and they're looking for ideas that are big ideas that explain the world and could hopefully explain the future. So I think we're in a better position now than in the 1950s and 1960s when Du Bois was practically eliminated from public discourse.
Folks today would like to use the word prophetic voice to describe Du Bois, but I think that you also think of him as a predictive voice as well.
Yes, and a scientific voice. And, you know, Du Bois always spoke of his work being scientific and being careful. And he, interestingly, was not this dry type of writer because he had tremendous literary skills. So he does scientific writing often in very poetic ways. But I think, Glenn, to be very honest and get to that point, yes, prophetic, yes, predictive, but prophetic and predictive in the sense of the capacity of science to think about and predict future trends, such as one of the things that Du Bois predicted as far back as 1947 in the book The World in Africa was the collapse of Europe. That the collapse of Europe was a conditionality for the liberation of humanity. And if we look at Europe and the Euro-American world today, we see disintegration. We see processes of collapse. The European Union in conflict. The American political system beset by crisis after crisis. So this collapse and weakening of Europe, the centers of world imperialism and white supremacy, seems to have been a prediction that Du Bois was, I think, pretty much correct about. So that's the kind of thinker he was.
Yes, what is France without Africa? What is Britain without India? And what is the United States without its empire?
And without plantation slavery. You're absolutely right. And, you know, Du Bois in the World in Africa, which is as much a philosophy of history as it is a history of Africa and the world, Du Bois successfully redefines the position of Africa in world civilizational history. And for him, the center of world history is Africa. And hence, the liberation of Africa is the liberation of humanity, by which I mean humanity cannot be free until Africa is free. America will never be free until Afro-America is free. The world's future is so anchored to the future of Africa and its diaspora in ways that we seldom think about. And Du Bois saw that. And that's one of the things that we want to talk about in this year of reading W.E.B. Du Bois. And if I could say just one other thing, Du Bois talked about in this novel that he wrote, a great political novel called The Dark Princess, he talked about the possibility of the unity of Pan-Africa and Pan-Asia in the fight against Western imperialism. That is another topic which we hope to explore as we celebrate Du Bois' 150th birthday.
Yes, many people do not give Du Bois credit as one of the seminal, preeminent Pan-Africanists, one of the architects of that philosophy.
Oh, yeah. And not only Pan-Africanism, but Pan-Africa organized upon the basis of a socialist economy. So he is not a conservative Pan-African or a reactionary cultural Pan-Africanist. He is a revolutionary Pan-Africanist. And another interesting point in his body of work is as he studied the Caribbean, and in particular the Haitian Revolution, in another of his novels, he has one of the characters reflecting upon what Du Bois, or this character speaking for Du Bois, called a Caribbean Communist Commonwealth. So in his writings, especially his writings after 1945, and maybe a little bit before that, he is constantly looking at the possibilities of the organization of Pan-Africa upon anti-imperialist and anti-capitalist foundations.
And so with your literacy campaign focused on the works of W.E.B. Du Bois, you're anticipating getting some new predictive scientific and prophetic work going on among young folks and not so young folks.
Absolutely. And you know, in the Saturday Free School, one of the foundations of our work is that knowledge comes from people, that knowledge is produced collectively, that knowledge which is designed to emancipate people must be knowledge from the people. And you know, we're very excited about entering into this year and connecting to our people, to our working class, to our poor people here in Philadelphia, and to create conditions for the creation of new knowledge, predictive knowledge, knowledge geared to empower ordinary people and hence to lead to their freedom and emancipation.
Information and cogitation for liberation.
Well, that's a good way to put it. I haven't heard that for a long time. Yes, I would say education, cogitation, and activism for liberation.
That was Dr. Anthony Montero speaking from Philadelphia.
The Philadelphia District Attorney's Office wants to kill Robert Lark, a 63-year-old black man who's been in prison for almost 40 years in the death of a shopkeeper. Lark is better known as Sugar Bear, a politically active prisoner whose death sentence was overturned 10 years ago because blacks were systematically kept off the jury. Sugar Bear is a prison contemporary of Mumia Abu-Jamal, a fellow black Philadelphian and the nation's best-known political prisoner. Black Agenda radio producer Kyle Frazier spoke with Dr. Johanna Fernandez, a professor of history and African American studies at Baruch College and an activist with the campaign to bring Mumia home. Fernandez was asked, is Sugar Bear Lark a political prisoner?
Sugar Bear is not a political prisoner in the traditional sense of the word. He was not imprisoned because of his political beliefs, much like Sundiata Akoli, Mumia, and many others. However, he seems to be targeted by the Philadelphia DA, perhaps because of his outspoken disposition against police corruption and prosecutorial misconduct in Philadelphia. He was, in fact, quoted telling Lynn Washington, a Philadelphia journalist, that, quote, "The Philadelphia District Attorney, Lynn Abraham, is costing the city a ton fighting police corruption cases," unquote. And he is known for all of his clippings on police and prosecutorial misconduct, not just in Philadelphia, but throughout Pennsylvania. And as your listeners probably know, Philadelphia has one of the most corrupt police departments in the country. In 1979, the entire police department was investigated by the Department of Justice, and the DOJ concluded that the level of homicidal behavior on the part of the police against Latino and African American defendants and the level of corruption in the Philadelphia Police Department, quote, "shocks the conscience," unquote. And that history of corruption, misconduct, tampering with evidence, killing people they arrest, mostly African Americans and Latinos, that has continued. Every 5 years, there is a massive scandal in Philadelphia involving the police. So it is possible that he is being targeted right now because he's been tracking police corruption over the past almost 40 years.
The 1979 investigation that occurred around the Philly Police Department, that is the same year that Sugar Bear was apprehended. Is that not right?
Correct. So the same year that he was apprehended, the jury that heard his trial did not know that the department was being investigated. So Sugar Bear was tried and convicted in 1979 for homicide.
And when you say that he has been targeted, how does that connect to the general approach to those who are within the Pennsylvania prison system and how DOC in Pennsylvania and the general so-called justice system deals with those who speak out against the injustices that occur within it?
Well, in Pennsylvania and throughout the country, we know that prisoners who defend other prisoners, who stand up against injustice in the slave ship, as you call it, the modern day slave ship, are usually targeted, beaten up, but mostly they're thrown in the hole. So we know that there is a systemic practice in prisons across the country wherein prisoners who stand up for themselves and others are targeted and put in the hole. In solitary confinement, that is. Of course, Sugar Bear was tried and convicted of murder, and he was put on death row. So he's been on death row in isolation for approximately 40 years.
Now, years back in the late 2000s, literary agent Francis Golden, the literary agent for Mumia Abu-Jamal, was quoted as saying that she visited 6 death row inmates, and to her knowledge, 5 of them were innocent of the crimes that they were on death row for. Is Sugar Bear one of those? Could you elaborate a bit on what all occurred in Sugar Bear's case and how his conviction came about.
Sugar Bear is indeed one of the death row inmates Francis Golden was referring to, who's innocent on Pennsylvania's death row. I take a step back before I start talking about Sugar Bear's case. Your audience may know that Pennsylvania has thrown out approximately 250 death penalty cases. That means that men who have been put on death row and spent years on death row, sometimes dozens of years on death row, have had their sentences and convictions overturned. Those are the ones that have been alive before execution. And we know that innocent men have been executed on death row. So the five that Francis Golden is referring to are just a very tiny percentage of the people on death row in Pennsylvania who are innocent today and who have been innocent historically. So now let's talk about the case of Robert Sugar Bear Lark. On Wednesday, October 18th, the Philadelphia prosecutor began to retry his case. Sugar Bear is 64 years old, and in 2007, a federal court overturned his conviction. And he should have been let go, released from death row, and released from prison at that time. A federal court determined that there were serious constitutional violations in his case, including discrimination in jury selection and ineffective counsel. The issue that he won in court was the Batson claim, and that refers specifically to discrimination in jury selection. And usually when a defendant wins a Batson claim, they are released immediately. However, the Philadelphia prosecutors decided to appeal the federal decision. And 10 years later, they have exhausted their appeals and are now deciding that they are going to retry the case. And they're not just retrying and reconvicting him, they're also pursuing the death penalty in his case. So in Philadelphia right now, this case is being talked about as the last death penalty case in Philadelphia, in part because, as you know, the death penalty both in Philadelphia and across the country is unpopular increasingly. Of course, something like 20-some-odd or 30 states still have the death penalty, but there seems to be growing opposition to the death penalty. So this decision on the part of the Philadelphia DA's office to seek the death penalty appears to be tone deaf in terms of where the country's moving. So that's what we're looking at right now. And the question is, why is the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office retrying a 64-year-old man who's been on death row for close to 40 years in a case that a federal court deemed unconstitutional?
Given that, as you say, there has not been an execution in the state of Pennsylvania since 1999, and given the fact that as long as these death row proceedings take, he would likely be in his 70s before Sugar Bear was even to be executed under these accusations. What might be the reasoning that the state of Pennsylvania is pursuing execution again in this case? What are some of the political stakes involved as far as you can tell?
I think that the case of Sugar Bear is a kind of show trial. It's a declaration of war, which I think is intended to send a message to Philadelphia's movement for Black Lives and other progressive forces. And the message that I think the DA's office is sending is that the deep state of criminal justice in the city is not going to abandon its racist law and order practices. It's not going to abandon those practices without a fight. And by the deep state, this is a term coined by a Philadelphia journalist. He called it the deep state of criminal justice in the city. By that, he meant the approximately 300 career prosecutors in Philadelphia and the police who support them. And this journalist was writing about the challenges that Larry Krasner, who's expected to win the election in November and who's expected to become the DA, the challenges he's going to face as a reform candidate. So let's take a step back, because this is a little confusing and a little contradictory. Essentially, there is more attention than there has been in a while on the Philadelphia DA's office. For one thing, Mumia Abu-Jamal, one of the most famous prisoners in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and the world, is experiencing a break of sorts. The DA's office has been asked to release the records in his case. Beyond that, there is increased attention on the DA's long history of racism, wrongful convictions, prosecutorial misconduct, and corruption. And this is a long-standing history. We're not talking about the last 10 years. This spans a century, at least. You might have read, or your listener might know, that the Philly DA convicts Black people at rates higher than any other county in the country. And Philadelphia is infamously known, that office in particular, the Philly DA's office, is infamously known for creating the McMahon tapes. The McMahon tapes were discovered in the 1990s. They are training videos that instruct prosecutors on how to eliminate Black people from the jury. And these tapes were created by the DA's office to train assistant DAs in the 1980s. We also know that the office works very closely with the city's police department. And as I mentioned previously, the Philly Police Department is one of the most violent and corrupt in the country. The first to have been investigated by the Department of Justice in 1979. So there is increased attention around all of these issues, in part because last spring, a social movement turned this relatively obscure civil rights attorney, Larry Krasner, into the likely winner of the city's DA election in November. It was a huge upset. It was written up in the Washington Post, the New York Times, the local newspapers in Philadelphia. This is the DA's election to watch. It was billed and referred to as the place where the anti-Trump revolution was going to happen. So it was a big upset, in part because Krasner is the only candidate in the history of Philadelphia to have gotten this far without the support of the Fraternal Order of Police. That's what's going on. This is the context within which Sugar Bear's case is being retried. And as if things weren't bad enough, and you mentioned this previously, the first Black district attorney in Philadelphia, Seth Williams, has been disbarred. And this October, he was convicted of corruption, and he is now in prison. So it seems that the DA's office in Philadelphia is going to hell in a handbasket. And on their way down, they are going to deploy vindictiveness. And as I said before, this seems to be a declaration of war. This seems to be a message that the DA's office is sending to the Black Lives Matter movement and to other progressive forces in Philadelphia, that they're essentially not going to give up without a fight, and that they are committed to law and order politics, and that they are first and foremost committed to convictions, and they really don't care about justice.
Given the fact that your entry into meeting Sugar Bear and interacting with him over the course of years was through your relationship with Mumia Abu-Jamal, what does this current attempt to retry under the death penalty Robert Sugar Bear Lark after all these years, what does all of that say to you about the character of prison slavery, an attempt to execute an elder who's been inside now for going on four decades?
Just imagining what it means to be in total and complete isolation for almost 40 years, and the barbarism and the lack of humanity of that reality is enough, but not for the Pennsylvania DA's office and not for the criminal justice system in the United States. 40 years on death row under the torture of death row, like executions in Pennsylvania stopped in 1999, but they were happening throughout the late 70s, 80s, and early to mid 90s. And if you're on death row, every time someone is executed, you are traumatized and reminded that your own day is coming. Death row prisoners talk about this all the time, the trauma and torture of living through an execution. And as if that were not enough, now they want to retry and resentence him after a federal court has thrown out the case. It just gives you a sense of the vindictiveness of the system and its determination to really annihilate, destroy, bring down a particular sector of American society, right? The descendants of slaves. And the question is, for what purpose? We know that the prison industrial complex is the third largest employer in the United States. Mumia has spoken to me about this, and I think he might have written this in one of his commentaries, that there are guards at SCI Mahanoy who make upwards of $100,000 with overtime. What, that job for someone with barely a high school diploma does not exist anywhere in the United States other than through the system of incarceration and extension of slavery by another name. So convictions over justice has its uses in the United States. One of them is that in an era of deindustrialization, it has sustained the American economy, and it continues to do so. And now the United States is, in fact, exporting the notion of prison nation abroad to Africa, the Middle East, and other places around the globe.
Dr. Johanna Fernandez of the Campaign to Bring Mumia Home.
In many cities across the United States, activists took to the streets this past weekend for National Stop Police Brutality Day. Larry Hamm, chairman of Newark, New Jersey's People's Organization for Progress, explains.
For some years now, I believe October 22nd had been identified as a national day against police brutality by a number of organizations, and we actually started to observe it maybe about 10 years ago. I believe it was a group called the October 22nd Coalition Against Police Brutality and the Criminalization of a Generation. So for about 10 years, I think we've been participating in this national day of protest against police brutality. But POP, for protests against police brutality, go all the way back to the 1980s
Well, this year's Stop Police Brutality Day is being marked in a whole range of localities, from Los Angeles down to Atlanta, across the river in Brooklyn.
Absolutely. People all over the country are observing this National Day of Police Brutality. It, of course, is an opportunity to draw attention to the cases that exist in their localities, but also to express solidarity with the victims of police brutality in other cities and to connect to those national cases. This is where the real value of those cases that draw national attention, this is where you see the real value of it, because the cases that have this national attention, you can connect those to local cases. We talk about Michael Brown, but there's a Michael Brown in every, there's an Eric Garner in every community. There's a Sandra Bland in every community, Diana Jones in every community, and on and on and on. So we try to use an approach that highlights the local cases and connects those to the national cases around the nation.
Well, certainly there's a commonality in every Black community of police brutality, but is there a commonality among these various cities that are marking National Stop Police Brutality Day? Is there a connection in terms of demands?
Well, I think the major demand that people have across the country is for Black community control or community control, depending on which group you're interacting with and which community you're going to. People want control over the police that police their communities. And so the demand for community control or Black community control is central to, I think, all of these struggles. Now, in some places, they have a modicum of control. They already have established police review boards. And in a few of those places, police review boards with subpoena power. But most cities and towns, particularly when you get down to the medium-sized cities and the smaller cities and towns, most of them don't have police review boards. So this is an expression. The police review board is a programmatic expression of the demand for community control, and it's being raised by communities all over the country.
You had high hopes for the proposal by Newark Mayor Ross Baraka to put some reins on the police through a version of community control. How's that been going?
Well, Glenn, it hasn't been going as well as I and others would like it to. We will be coming up on the second anniversary of when Mayor Ross Baraka signed the executive order to establish a police review board in Newark. And that review board is not up and running yet because the PBA, the police associations that represent the police in Newark, have taken the city to court over especially the issue of subpoena power. The Mayor Baraka tried to create a police review board that would have subpoena power, and the police associations are challenging it on the basis that the city cannot bestow subpoena power on a municipal agency, that this is a power that can only be conferred by the state of New Jersey. So that's where the contention is, and they have tied this thing up in court for about a year now. It took them a year to actually get the city into court, and now that they're in there, it seems that this thing is dragging out. So the police review board at Newark, which has been lauded and praised by people, individuals, and groups around the country, it's not up and running yet. Now, they are having meetings, but they have not yet resolved or investigated a police brutality case and cannot do so because the police associations filed an injunction and the judge issued an order saying that no action can be taken until this matter is legally resolved. And I don't know when a resolution to this stalemate is going to take place.
The police unions must be riding high right now with Donald Trump in office and no possibility of federal pressures against police departments that abuse their Black citizens.
Well, that's exactly right. The police have in the White House their guy, Donald Trump, number 45. He campaigned on Make America Great Again, which we all know is code for Make America White Again. And he campaigned on law and order, which has been a tactic of the Republicans since the Nixon administration, which is another code for we're going to put Negroes back in their place. And it's also code for to let the police know that they can do what they want to do. And that's what they have been doing. The Ku Klux Klan endorsed Donald Trump and the 338,000 member Fraternal Order of Police, with its many branches, chapters around the country, endorsed Donald Trump. Trump, in turn, appointed the unrepentant and unreconstructed racist segregationist Jeff Sessions as the United States Attorney General, the Chief Law Enforcement Officer over the Justice Department. And among his first orders after taking office was that they would not pursue the implementation of any more consent decrees to be imposed on local police forces. Sessions himself said that we're going to stay out of the way of local police forces. And this has sent a signal to police around the country, essentially saying, y'all can continue to do what you've been doing, and we're not going to get in your way. As a matter of fact, one might actually make an argument that the Sessions Justice Department is on the side of those beliefs that oppress and victimize people. I mean, witness the situation from Charlottesville, Virginia, where they didn't arrest first the people, the Klansmen and Nazis that were down there beating up people. They went and arrested the black victims first. So it's a situation where the FOP, they knew who they had to get in the White House, and they got him in the White House, and in turn, their political power resulted in Sessions being appointed the U.S. Attorney. And he's not going to do anything about police brutality.
We've recently learned of a new innovation in national police behavior, and one that apparently is not new, that is not a new thing from the Trump administration, and that is the FBI's designation of a category of people they describe as black identity extremists, which the FBI might consider to include people who mark national days to stop police brutality.
Absolutely. This is the fruit of the Trump administration. You know, this is the fruit of their labor. And again, this is the paradox and the irony, but it's really not ironic when you extrapolate out what Trump represented when he ran for office.
These reports of this new classification of black identity extremists seem to indicate that they predate, this classification predates Donald Trump and probably originated during the Obama administration.
Well, one could logically go back and say that we could take it all the way back. We could probably say that every administration, to one degree or another, has targeted groups in the black community that have, in an unfiltered way, tried to uphold the interests of the black community and fight for the interests and fight to protect the black community. I mean, we could go all the way back to COINTELPRO and talk about the FBI's attempt to infiltrate black organizations, to destroy those organizations, and to assassinate their leaders, either physically, economically, politically, or otherwise. This has happened to a greater or lesser degree in almost all administrations. We saw that during the Obama administration, that police chiefs across the country were in fact coordinating their efforts to stop Black Lives Matter protests. I remember some of those meetings and some of the fact that the police chiefs were having national conference calls trying to cope because a national movement had come into existence against police brutality. So, yes, it happened during the Obama administration. It happened in previous administrations. And right now, it's happening under the Trump administration. But what I think is noticeable about this effort on the Trump administration is that we've had a rise in activity among white supremacists and racist hate groups. And what they're trying to do is, in fact, take the spotlight off of those groups and put it on groups which they call black extremists, but which are really groups just trying to fight to protect the interests of black people and black communities.
Yes, they seem to be saying that there is a new threat that justifies or requires new kinds of repression.
Absolutely. And they have the wherewithal now with the technology that is available that hadn't been available in the 20th century. They have the wherewithal to monitor our activities like never before. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, no matter what they do, we're going to keep fighting. They do what they have to do. We do what we have to do, because we're not going to sit idly by and let black people be shot down in the street like dogs and be silent about it or do nothing about it. Those days are over. This younger generation that's out here today, who has been out in the street since the murder of Michael Brown and even before that, they're not going to take this stuff laying down. And I predict that we're going to see a wave after wave, not just one wave, but wave after wave of black activists, black youth activism, black student activism, and black community activism. We're going to see wave after wave across the country, because we're suffering. We're not fighting simply because we want to fight. We're fighting because somebody got their boot on our neck, and we got to get that boot off our neck by any means necessary.
Yes, so in a sense, this new categorization of black activism could be seen as a kind of backhanded acknowledgement that there is something resembling a movement going on.
Absolutely. If they're targeting, and they publicly state that they're targeting black groups or what they call black extremist groups, I don't even know what group they're talking about. Are they talking about Black Lives Matter? I haven't seen Black Lives Matter people engaged in anything violent. I mean, they've arrested some individuals for breaking some windows and stuff like that during some of the uprisings that took place in Baltimore and Ferguson, but I haven't seen anyone in the leadership of any Black Lives Matter movement proclaim any type of violent cause or anything like that. I haven't seen it. So really what they're trying to do, they just want to stop black activism, period. Whether they openly advocate use of violence or don't advocate use of violence, because quite frankly, I have not come across any organization that, except for the right of self-defense, which is the right of every human being to defend themselves against unjust violence, you know, I haven't seen anyone advocate any type of aggressive violence against people. So this is just a failed attempt to try to squash this movement that rose up in this country in the latter part of the 21st century. You know, because black people have been struggling hard against police brutality now at least a quarter of a century. I mean, we were always fighting against police brutality, but it's become a front and center issue going back. I mean, in Jersey, we could take it back to Earl Faison, who was killed by the police in 1999. In New York, they could take it that same year, Amadou Diallo. And people have been waging a relentless struggle against police brutality since then. And it's taken various forms and various movements. The latest permutation is under the banner of Black Lives Matter. But as I said, there will be wave after wave, because people are not going to sit idly by and be killed like dogs in the street. Nobody be held accountable. Nobody be charged for a crime. Nobody be indicted. Nobody be found guilty, you know, and business as usual. People are not going to take it. And the Trump administration, they don't understand that all these moves that they are making, from the identification of black groups as extremists by the FBI to efforts at voter suppression, all this is going to do is cause black people to fight harder. They think they're going to squash a movement. They are, in fact, aiding in the creation of a movement with their repressive tactics and policies.
That was Larry Hamm, chairman of the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey.
Black women are the fastest growing population in U.S. prisons. At the Pennsylvania Prison for Women in Muncie, inmate Terry Harper presented this essay for Prison Radio.
This piece is about a conversation that I had with one of my sisters about how I am looked upon as a woman who has committed a crime. And this is what came to my mind. Eve tempted Adam with the apple, so how dare you say a woman should be docile and soft, and how dare you look at me differently because I'm a woman who committed a crime. Please be clear. I believe and trust Almighty God implicitly. I acknowledge that everything does happen for a reason, and I've identified why I became a statistic. I was naively fearless. I just wanted to take care of me and my baby sis and help my mothers. I was so wrapped up in what I wanted and thought I needed, I did not consider all the paths that intersected and or intertwined with my life. I was not abused or hurt coming up. I knew love, friendship, family, and hardship. I was awake. The problem was my lack of understanding of faith and gratitude, stillness, and contemplation. I allowed myself to be caught up and lost in the hype. I allowed myself to squeeze in where I did not fit. I allowed corruption. How about that for the cycle of life? I feel my strength. I embrace my ability to have others listen and correct their behaviors. I am humbled to be called one of service. Those things I took for granted. In so doing, I cannot count who all I failed or hurt. I can, however, continue to listen, learn, evolve, and be of service. I will undoubtedly take it to the next level when and if given a chance. Will you be a part of that success? Of a societal change that shifts us out of more problems and reaffirms our status as the land of the free and the home of the brave. I, too, ate the proverbial apple, shamed myself, covered it with the leaves of patience, earned trust, compassion, and service, and now live anew. And I'm far less than the two who started it all. So aren't I redeemable also? Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.